Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Good morning, Rapido.
Good morning. And that was Ann, and this is Peter, just in case you're puzzling. Mm-hmm. What are we up to today?
Today we're doing authors. We have three authors of three different books, essentially very different from each other.
Yeah, but they're all books. They're not just books. I mean, they're fascinating stories.
Right.
As well, they're tremendously worthwhile additions to your library, but the interviews themselves are also great stories. And first up, we have, in a sense, I guess, a collaborator or a rival or whatever you like to call him, Mike Kolomenko, who is actually a media person in New York City. He does radio.
I don't think he's exactly a rival. I would call him a colleague.
A colleague. There you go. He does a variety of different things. I think he undoubtedly has a blog and all kinds of things. But his contribution to the world.
He's fun too.
Yeah. Well, you'll find that out as you hear him talk. But his contribution to the world at large is a very thoroughgoing review, not critique, I guess, of New York restaurants, which I think you'll find invaluable, and he's also a fun guy to listen to. So shall we turn to the interview?
Mike? Well, we have a perspective on dining in Manhattan from somebody who really knows, Mike Kolomenko, who is a personality, a media personality in his own right, a chef, a graduate of the Culinary Institute of America. He worked in places like the Four Seasons, the Ritz-Carlton, so he knows kind of his way around New York and around food.
And he's either a colleague or a competitor. I'm not sure which. Welcome to the program.
Yeah,
Mike.
Welcome, Mike. And your book is The Food Lover's Guide to New York City. Tell us what this is about. Is it a reaction to these food blogs everywhere with their recommendations, ratings?
Yeah, it's kind of a reaction to all the above. I'm originally from Philadelphia, so the other end of that, your fair state of Pennsylvania. Cooked all through junior high, high school, a couple of years of college, and then decided I really liked cooking more than what I was studying, so.
Which is true of many
college.
People.
Yeah, which is true of a lot of people. Dropped out of college and went to the Culinary Institute. And upon graduation, went straight to New York in January of 1982, which seems like a long time ago. It was a real different town back then, restaurant-wise, because, heck, it was a long time ago, and the city's changed quite a bit.
Yeah, well, which is one of my questions, by the way, is what I've always resisted writing one of these guidebooks, because by the time it hits the press, half the restaurants are closed, the chefs have changed.
Yeah, luckily not half. Now, the good news was, in order to write the book, it isn't, you know, there's guides and there's guides, and I didn't want to write a book about, you know, 110 places that just opened up in the last 5 minutes, because you're right, a lot of those places, just as the business is, they'll be out of business in a couple of years.
Well, what about not just new ones? What about Café des Artistes?
Well, that was this past week, and you can never stop that. The danger of writing anything that goes to print that has 6 month lead time in a town like New York is that by the time you do your final edit, you're going to have restaurants that closed. And this economy, I think, just exacerbated it. But having said that, this is sort of a longer view of the city. And I joked with my editor that it really took 25 years to write the book, because I don't know how many restaurants are in it, but we've got 400 and some pages worth of recommendations for restaurants, stores, bars, wine bars,
markets,
food shopping.
Markets.
Yeah, markets and all that. And so that was the tip of the iceberg. What isn't in the book is all of the places that you had to go to that you decided you really didn't like. Or maybe you once liked and went back again and just thought they weren't of interest this time around. So it was a long way in coming.
So when you put them in there, because you think they're okay to go to. You don't, if it's not any good, you don't include it.
Yeah, I think there's like a rule of thumb. I didn't want to be a restaurant critic because I was for too long on the kitchen side of those swinging doors. And, you know, critics are tough. I think a lot of critics are good writers. I'm not sure many of them know as much about food as they'd like to think.
Wait a minute.
But they can have a real,
hello.
They can have a real hegemon. They can really, you know, they can put a place in and out of business. So
I guess I was kind of an exception. I owned a restaurant in Philadelphia, as a matter of fact.
No, well, you know, if you look at go back at the New York Times, which is our big paper, you know, in Manhattan, and you know, Ruth Reichel was sort of the exception, and that Ruth kind of came out of the business, and I think it informed her writing. But
Ruth,
you know,
and
Bill
I, by the way, you talk about your going to school. Ruth and I both went to the University of Michigan and got a master's in art history.
Well, and now you can, before meals, you can go to museums and do well. No, but but the idea was there was this need. There's billions of dollars spent every year in New York on food, not just by tourists, by residents who eat out on a really frequent basis.
Yeah.
New York apartments are famously inadequate when it comes to kitchens. New Yorkers are just busy people. And the Zagat Guide became this big deal. It basically took over the industry in terms of guidebooks.
Did you ever read Mimi Sheraton's article where she actually went and tested the Zagat ratings in cities? Did you read that?
You know, Mimi's a neighbor of mine in the West
okay.
Village, and I'm a huge fan of hers. I think she was one of the great food writers of any generation. And I still bump into her on the street, but that article I haven't read, so tell me.
Well, she found out that the ratings didn't hold up unless you were, like, in San Francisco or Manhattan. I mean, you go to Austin, Texas, and you don't have the same thing at all.
Yeah, and I'm not so sure. I'll be honest. I'm not so sure that Zagat in New York has, you know, it's a funny kind of a way to do things. I mean, it's interesting. There's a meritocracy to it in that there's a lot of people writing. It's not the opinion of any one person. Yeah. But on the other hand, if you know the history of Zagat and you kind of know who were the early contributors to it and who shaped it, it was kind of a couple of zip codes and a couple of professions.
Yeah. And not only that, but some one of our guests pointed out, for example, how likely is it that Gramercy Tavern could maintain that that rating for all these years?
Well, that's the part. In the preface to the book, I mentioned that there's like this positive feedback loop in the press where if enough people say it's good, then it just has to be good. It's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. And the perfect example is what you just said. I think if you look at the last 10 or 15 years of Zagat, you're going to find the same 15 or 20 restaurants in the same top 20 position. And New York has changed a lot. And the scene has just moved and gotten better, and I don't think they've kept up with it. And I also would argue that, I guess back to why I wrote the book, when I used to travel to Paris as a young man without much money, and I only had a couple of weeks, you know, as a chef in the city, and I had a couple of weeks off in the summer, and you travel to learn, you travel to eat, to learn, to sort of build up your palate. And how do you make a decision in Paris? Well, Patricia Wells, the great food writer, they had those wonderful books, Food Lover's Guide to Paris, Food Lover's Guide to Bistros, and I remember, I still have my copies of those books with all the little check marks and all the little dog-eared corners of the pages, and she was basically right. She was my Sherpa. Yeah. The same way that when Pauline Kael wrote movie reviews for the New Yorker. You know, if you find someone whose taste you agree with.
Exactly.
Then you say, okay, you know, I only have one or two nights a week out. Why do I want to waste my time with a bad movie? If Pauline says it's good, I usually agree, and sure enough, I did. And that book didn't exist. So that's the long-winded answer, is after, you know, coming out of the industry as a chef and then sort of turning into a media person, I just looked at the guidebook sector and thought it was woefully underserving people that were smart and wanted to know a little more than the three sentences or two sentences you're going to get in the Zagat Guide that has, you know, 2,500 entries, but precious little more than a phone number, a couple of numerical scores, an address code, and what credit cards they take.
Now, how did you actually put that? I mean, did you eat at all these places?
Yeah, I did. And
you must be a...
How many pounds is that?
You must be more than a 39 long, which is...
No, there's three stories. I mean, for the longest time, I was pretty thin when I was younger, and I could get away with eating out a lot. And then I hit my 40s like a lot of people.
Like
us. Metabolism slowed down, and I gained... Oh, between the age of 40 and 50, I probably gained 5 pounds a year and woke up one day a couple of years ago and just said, I don't want to be this guy. You know, I was, because it got very hard. I'm an active guy. I swim, I run, I exercise all the time. And I'm 5'8", and at 250 pounds, that wasn't fun anymore. So okay, about 2.5, 3 years ago, I actually just changed my diet completely.
I'm always curious when people do this.
I just ate less. I have to eat out for dinner. The problem is my job description it demands that I'm in New York City X amount of nights a week going to restaurants. So I know for a busy guy, you know, 2,500 calories a day is a pretty good benchmark. If you work out, you know, if not, you can get closer to 2,000 calories. And I knew that I was going to get a lot of that from 7 o'clock on, which isn't exactly what you're supposed to do, but that's what I get paid to do. So I would taught my stomach that it could get by with less, and literally sort of retrained my brain and, of course, the body.
That's it.
I started eating much smaller portions.
That's it.
A lot of snacks during the day, a lot of fruit, a lot of nuts, a lot of vegetables.
Yes,
and then at night,
so
I would have regular dinners. But what happened after a couple of months was I absolutely noticed that my ability to eat portion sizes had greatly diminished. I could not eat the same amount of food that I used to eat, you know, 3 months before that.
Well,
and that was when I knew I was
well, that's a great, that's a great thing. You're on the right track. So, but back to the answer to the question. So the book is really the result of the research that you did for your day job, if you like.
Yeah, research that I did, and then, of course, because when I was a chef, you know chefs, you're in the industry. I mean, what am I going to do on my night off? Either I'm going to cook dinner at home, which is a good possibility, especially if I'm not in Manhattan, if I'm at home in my house in Cape May. But if I'm at home in New York and I have a night, I want to go out to eat because I want to see what other people are doing.
Right.
So
right.
Once I was freed from working in kitchens 5 or 6 nights a week as a chef and then was unleashed and able to go around the town, I found that I was eating out on a regular basis 3 to 4 nights a week and over the course of, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 years, and that's when you begin to say, okay, now, you know, there's a book in here, and some of the restaurants have been open since the 60s and 70s, other opened in the last 10 years, some in the last just a couple. But, yeah, every restaurant and every shop and every wine store, every place in that bake shop is a restaurant that I like. And that was one of your other questions, I think, was I didn't want to rate restaurants, like give them points or stars or something. If they're in the book,
you
I like them, and I think there's a certain New Yorkness about them. I think they have a quality that merits a visit. So there's no chains. There's not going to be any.
Okay, now, Mike, you're now my new best friend, and I'm going to ask you an honest a question and hope for an honest answer.
Good luck getting in.
Well, this is what I'm going to say. How could this David Chang, who I love, I mean, on a personal basis,
mm-hmm.
How can he win all these James Beard Awards with all these, because I'm a juror too, I mean, they're all over the country,
mm-hmm.
when, how many, 14 people can get in there a night?
Well, you know, you're making a great point, and I think that part of the answer is you and I are talking for your radio show, so this is one form of media. There's an awful lot of younger people in the media today who blog, who write for publications like Time Out New York City Search or New York Magazine, for whom the blog is a big component of what they have to do daily. Because there's a news cycle, I think that everyone's looking for something new. You don't read a lot about, which is to me kind of sad, you don't read a lot about great chefs that are over 45 or 50. You know, Jacques Pepin, to me, is one of my heroes. I often say that a guy like Jacques Pepin forgot more about cooking than most kids today that are in restaurants know.
Right.
I mean, Jacques is just a tremendous resource, but and there's a fair amount of guys like him out there that, you know, French or American or Italian who just, but the press wants new. They want new,
yeah.
They want young, they want a story. And David was all of that, and he really came around at the right time, and it wasn't an instant success. You know, David, I know guys that worked with David when he was a line cook at Danielle and Kraft and said he wasn't even a great line cook. He was average. I mean, this guy wasn't like you were playing next to Michael Jordan. You know, he was just a guy. And he opened up Sambar. He opened up a little noodle shop first, which was okay. That was easy. And then Sambar, which almost went out of business because he had two menus, a menu that he served before 11 o'clock, and then he had this really funky late-night menu.
The chef's menu.
And all the chefs kept coming in late at night saying, dude, you know, why don't you serve this menu when you open the door at 7? Because the other stuff, it just is not selling. There's nobody here. And he did. And actually, I think the press kind of saved him. There's a couple of writers, a couple of bloggers that really sort of helped keep his stock in play. And Sambar became hugely popular. I'm not really a fan.
I'm not. I mean, we've been there.
It's okay, you know, the service goes from like average to bad, the food's relatively inconsistent.
Well, he's gonna open a bigger place.
He's opening up where Jeffrey's the Carrying used to be, which is the Chambers Hotel. That'll be interesting.
Where Town was.
Town was in the
That's
basement.
That's in the basement.
Yeah.
So he's gonna be in the basement on top of everything else, huh?
But it's a beautiful space. I mean, the way they did Town, when you walk down it, I mean, you went from the street level, you go past the bar, you go down kind of this stairway that turns a couple of times, and the ceiling's soaring, and you actually do get some natural light, although it's coming in right off the sidewalk. It does. You don't feel subterranean.
Yeah, I liked Town. I liked the food.
The value proposition of this book, because there is about 2 pages of small print about each restaurant that's in there. And I think it's tremendously useful because it really is a description that you can use to figure out if this sounds like the kind of place you're interested in, which the Zagat guy doesn't do, the Michelin guy doesn't do. Reviews frequently don't do because they have an attitude. And that's what you get for $19.95. You pick one place that's, because it's described well here. You're going to have saved the $20 that you would have wasted if you'd gone somewhere else.
Well, thanks. And I really tried to cover the restaurant scene in terms of price points too, because I think it's really easy as foodies in New York to become very four-star, three-star centric, because there's a lot of very, very good restaurants in town. And there's a lot of very expensive restaurants, because to run a good restaurant costs money. But so who am I writing that book for? You know, the guys that work on Wall Street, the guys and the gals that are lawyers? No. So I wanted to write a book that was more, egalitarian, and there's an off price point. I have expensive, moderate, inexpensive. I forget how many denominations I use, but there's a whole lot of places in the book where you can get a great meal for $25 to $50 a person, which in New York is not expensive.
No, I field tested the book as best I could without getting too hungry. And I think there's only one place in New York that we went that isn't in there, and that's called Commerce.
Commerce should have been in there. Commerce is on Commerce Street.
Right.
I know the chef, I know Harold, and I know the owner. The owner comes out of, he's one of the partners that Drew had at Montrachet, Tony Zazula. And Harold's, these guys are really, really good. Commerce, when we do the next edition, Commerce will be in there.
So you're planning on editions?
Of course, John Wiley has to say yes to that. The book has to sell well enough, but I think I've got a PBS show in New York that airs weekly that's been on for, we're going into our 10th season, so it's 10 years. And I do radio in the city, so I think in New York alone, I think we should sell enough copies to justify doing another version of it.
I was really complimenting you
on the
extent of the coverage. Because we go to New York a lot, we haven't eaten nearly as many of these restaurants as you have, but you've got a very thorough list. Now I'm gonna put you on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
Before we go, out of all the entries in the book, let's take the best in New York, a moderate price point, and an inexpensive price point, and give us your favorites.
Okay, well,
three different price points. The best.
The best is kind of easy, and I think this is where you'll get a lot of agreement.
Okay.
I think on any given day, if you could secure a table at Per Se.
That's what I thought you'd
at
say.
At Danielle, at Le Bernardin.
Bernardin's fabulous, isn't it?
Yeah, they are. They're all world class. I mean, these are restaurants that didn't exist at that level. There was no cooking at that level, 15 years ago or 10 years ago in New York City, because there just wasn't any cooking like that in America. The ingredients weren't there,
yeah.
But now there is. So I think most of the guidebooks, I think, will agree on the top 10 or 15 in New York.
Could we add one to your list, Chanterelle?
Yeah, no, I love it. But, Chanterelle is, it'll be interesting. I just was with Roger Daghorn, who is the sommelier.
Oh, we interviewed, he's on the program.
He's, one of the most brilliant sommeliers in the country, for sure, and he couldn't be a nicer guy. Karen and David closed the restaurant this summer for a renovation.
Right.
And I think what they're going to do is reopen it in this new economy, and probably for their own survival sake,
as
a slightly less formal, probably a little less expensive, and probably offering a couple of different price points in terms of how you want to eat. They're going to have a bar now that they didn't have before, and I suspect it's going to go, I don't want to say down market in a pejorative way, but, it used to be what it was.
Smart.
That's a great update. Now, let's move.
Question, though, about the Per Se is, in this current reality, economic as well as just attitude, how many people, of course it is small, want to sit for 3.5 to 4.5 hours eating a Per Se, price?
Yeah, well, I guess there's two answers. The one answer is not many. The second answer is because Thomas Keller has the kind of profile that he has. The French Laundry, arguably, on any given night, is the best restaurant in the country. You've been there, I've been there, it's phenomenal. And I think he's got legions of fans around the world now. So on any given night in New York, I don't know how many passports are sitting in that room, but I'm guessing you have maybe half the rooms New York and the other half from somewhere else.
Okay.
And they're in the city, and they made the reservation knowing they were going to be in New York because it's a destination.
Okay, now middle market then.
Well, it gets interesting with middle market. There's, again, some guys that are under the radar that I think do wonderful work. There's a restaurant on Elizabeth Street called Peasant that I'm a huge fan of.
Oh, yeah. Gail Green likes Peasant.
Yeah, a lot of people do, and a lot of chefs love. I discovered it because in the span of about 5 or 6 days, maybe 2 weeks of being in New York and filming and bumping in the chef friends of mine, completely randomly. I had three different chefs. Eric Repair was one of them. Christian Louvrier was another one, and I forget the third. But I had three different friends say, you know, have you been to Peasant yet? And I was like, no. And you got to try it. So I went, and of course I saw what they did, which was this wonderful, authentic, rustic cooking. Frankie DiCarlo's the chef. He'd worked in Bari in southern Italy on the coast. Built the ovens himself. Most of the ovens are wood-fired. It's a great restaurant. It's not terribly expensive. And I think you'd be hard-pressed to have a bad plate there. Another restaurant that's in that same kind of category is a little restaurant on 14th Street called Crispo. That's in my neighborhood. Frankie Crispo's the chef. I've known Frankie for...
Oh, no, that's 20... one I really don't know.
Well, you should say he's a Philadelphia expat. He was the chef that opened up DeLillo's, which was a big restaurant in Center City, Philadelphia, and that was in between his New York stints. And he opened this restaurant right after 2001, 2002, and again, a chef who's there all the time, and that's another thing that I try and champion, is the idea that if you're opening a restaurant as a chef or an owner, that you're there.
And
not out doing golf tours and wondering how to make the next TV show. There's something to be said for people that own businesses that are there. I just think they're run better, and they reflect that. And then another little funky place that I'm sure you know, and again, another chef owner who I adore, a little restaurant called Prune.
Oh, yeah, I love her.
Yeah, Gabrielle's great.
Yeah,
it's just off
nice.
Of, and that'll lead me to your third answer, which is
go
inexpensive
ahead,
and great. And I think then we could talk about a couple of restaurants, and then we could talk about not necessarily having to be tied into restaurants, because formal restaurants, for example, right across from Prune is Katz's Deli.
Yeah, right.
Katz's is on Houston. Prune is on First Street, 200 yards away. And, you know, Katz's is one of those places where, you know, it's sad the delis have fallen out of favor in New York because it's a very Jewish town and that's the tradition.
Yeah, but they all went into the hands of Cambodians.
Well, but Katz's is really good.
Yeah,
and if you're
Katz's
looking to have an inexpensive dinner or a lunch that might hold you, you know, you can eat salad for dinner, the pastrami at Katz's is as good as any you'll find anywhere. The corned beef is great. They have a couple of different hot dogs. They have a Nobelwurst, a big garlic hot dog that's great. They have brisket. And it's just a classic. It's because it's cafeteria style. You walk in, they hand you a little card, you get in line, you order your food, the guy behind the counter stamps your card for you, you give him a little tip in a jar, he makes your sandwich and gives you some meat to eat, and then you sit down with, you know, 400 people that are eating there. So Katz's is great. There's some wonderful restaurants in Chinatown, because I always recommend, again, that Chinatown in New York, probably the more interesting Chinatowns are now in Brooklyn and in Queens.
Yeah.
But downtown Manhattan still has a great, vibrant Chinatown. A place like New Green Bow is just a wonderful restaurant on Bayard Street. I've never had a bad meal there. I've never had a bad plate there. And that's, you know, we're talking $25 a person for dinner if you can eat a lot. You know, 20 or less if you don't. And a third place that's more serious, but I think is kind of speaks to the new New York, is a little place called Cafe Katja, K-A-T-J-A. It's on Orchard Street. Right around Ludlow and Broome in that neighborhood,
yeah.
Which is this Lower East Side, changing neighborhoods, becoming very hip these days. And it's a couple of chefs that really knew what they were doing, who wanted to do something simple. One of them's Austrian, and it's kind of this Austrian-influenced restaurant with a great Austrian wine list, superb beer list, schnapps collection of artisanal schnapps,
and
wonderful plates of simple food that come in at like $8, $9, $10, $11 a plate. You could eat like a king at Cafe Katja for next to nothing.
Well, Mike, it's been a pleasure to have you on the program. Listeners, this is an invaluable book, and Mike's an invaluable resource and a wonderful guy to talk to as well.
Yeah, Mike, I want to hang with you and talk more.
Maybe we'll meet in Manhattan sometime.
Well, we should do that for sure. It'd be a pleasure. Thanks for having me. And, you know, I really appreciate it because the book, it took kind of a lifetime to write, but it's great to have it out there. So
well,
I think
it's really, Peter said to me, I can't even believe how thorough this guy is.
Yeah. Thank you, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, as we said, he's a fun guy. And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And as you know, we are both devotees of connectivity.
Oh, there we go. Big words today.
Yeah,
huh?
Big words.
All that really means is you can communicate with us simply on our homepage by clicking Facebook,
Twitter,
or email.
Blog.
Or you can go to our blog. So all of those are available to you. How much fun can it be? And I'm sure you're having a wonderful time with all this social networking stuff. I know Anne does. I don't know what she did with the time before Twitter came along. But anyway, let's get on with the program. That's a good idea. Let's get on with the program.
Yeah, next up, there's a term we've come to anticipate will pop up anytime you talk about restaurants or food, which is farm to table. With a twist on this, our next guest, a pastry chef and a chef, wrote a book called Earth to Table. He will explain in our interview with him what exactly it was they did by way of experimenting with this concept.
Yeah, and she might explain it too, because there's two of them, and they're really fascinating people. They put together a book that I think...
I was actually following him on Twitter without them, because she's on that too.
Let's
just listen to the interview.
Well, I'm looking at an absolutely smashing book. It's making me hungry, as a matter of fact, and I can... retweet, can I say that? Retweet Michael Pollan, who says about it, this is a beautiful book in every way. I'd like to welcome the authors, Jeff Crump and Bettina Shorman. Thank you for joining us and On the Menu.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us. We're happy to be here.
Well, you said it took 3 years of your life, and I'll tell you, it's worth it to see this book. Every single thing about it is perfect.
Wow, thanks.
Thank you.
I mean, the content, the photographs, the food styling, the philosophy about it, everything. How about one of you describing the purpose of the book? Who was your audience that you intended?
Well, our audience, tongue-in-cheek, it's everyone who eats. That's sort of how we like to project who we want to talk to. But ultimately, it's for people... I think it's two different things. It's people who love food and who are passionate about food and want to share the exploration of food, but also it's for people who may not understand good food or be connected with good food and how it's grown. And this book is our discovery of local food and, you know, everything that's good about food. And we just wanted to share that, and hopefully people would be inspired to discover food again for themselves.
Now, I think if our listeners are astute, they would have picked up about indicating that you were Canadian.
Yes.
but he didn't say, hey.
just wait.
Anytime now. Now, when you're not spending 3 years writing books, let's give us a starting point. What you actually do from day to day?
Well, we are chefs. Jeff is an executive chef, and I am a pastry chef. And we're in Hamilton, Ontario, Ancaster more specifically, which is a bit of a suburb. And we cook, and we...
You cook in the same place?
Yeah, we cook in the kitchen every day.
And you cook at a restaurant called the Ancaster Old Mill.
Okay, good. Okay, let's get that out there. And
our restaurant.
Does it have a website? Let's record that in if it does.
The website is ancasteroldmill.com.
Okay.
Ancaster Old Mill.
It's like Lancaster without the L on it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so we're chefs. We're cooks by trade. And every day, Bettina makes 100 loaves of bread and the pastries for the restaurants and cook on the hotline. And that's what we do. We cook every day.
Okay. How long have you had this restaurant?
Excuse me.
Well, the restaurant's owned by a family, the Cicconi family. It's been around for 32 years.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Tina's worked here for 8 years, and I've worked here for 6.
Okay, and you've all worked other places as well. You've some interesting ones, Jeff. Where have you worked?
Well, I worked at my first sort of real job was at Chez Panisse in Berkeley, California. That's sort of where this whole philosophy and how I view food came from. Obviously, Alice Waters' work is famous throughout the world, and I was influenced by her, just as thousands of other chefs have been. I've worked at a very great restaurant in Vancouver called Lumiere. I spent some time in Toronto, and since I became a chef, in order to get other experience, we do things what's known as stages.
Yes.
And that's basically going to famous kitchens and working for free.
Yes.
I did it at the Fat Duck in England. I actually worked at Per Se in New York, Kraft, and spent some time in Paris.
When were you at the Fat Duck, Jeff?
November of 07.
And that, you said that was just the most incredible experience?
Yeah, I would say it was quite an experience. I'm not a young cook anymore, and started at 8 a.m. and we finished around midnight, 6 days a week. The last few years I've been, you know, an executive chef, so my tasks are vastly different than apprentices, but I was back to being an apprentice, shucking oysters and chopping onions and eviscerating quails and pigeons. It was a very incredible experience.
But you said that you thought Heston Blumenthal was just a most marvelous guy, and you profile him in the book.
Yes, he was the one who really kicked off the chef profiles.
Yeah, explain that. That's something you don't actually, you don't always have this in a cookbook, but I wouldn't actually describe this as a cookbook. Just explain to us what it's like. It's arranged by seasons. Hello?
Hi, yeah. It's really a bit of a documentary. It was a year in our life and our relationship with Manor Run Farm, and that was the genesis of it was to document that year, but we ended up wanting to make it an approachable book for people to read, so we added the spotlights of the other chefs and other people in America and obviously Heston in England who are also doing really great things because we think it's important to celebrate people as well. And then the how-tos are the tips on how people can incorporate the Earth Table philosophy into their own lives. So
no,
how
I didn't.
To talk at a farmer's market and how to plant an herb garden.
Oh, yeah, that I wanted to mention that you have really detailed tips on how to plant an herb garden. That's good. And a section on canning, which is also very popular now.
Yeah. And so we want people to use the book. We want them to read it. And we thought the more ways that people can approach the book, the more likely they are to bring it into their lives. And we tried to not make it too difficult. It's not a chef book. We kept the recipes very simple. You know, some of the recipes have one or two ingredients, and that's it, and the cooking methods are quite simple.
Well, you gave me an idea of what I couldn't figure out what to do with sorrel, and besides cream of sorrel soup. You have that in here.
Yeah, we have it with egg.
Frittata,
yeah.
We have sorrel growing in our garden just outside the restaurant.
Yeah, well, we have it, and I even offered the chef up the street and the restaurant up the street could take all he wanted. He could cut it down and grow back
so,
up.
So he did. So he did.
This is a very classic sauce pureed with beurre blanc and served with salmon. That's a very classic French sauce from the Trois Gros brothers in France.
Yeah, I love it how it sort of melts when you're making a sauce like that for fish. Yes. You have sections on farmers markets. You really cover all the bases here. Yeah, I said you have a section on farmers markets, and I said you've pretty much covered all bases in this book. It's a real value.
Well, we just have a lot to say, and I think we learned a lot over the years. And food world is just, we're students of the food world, as anyone is, and there were so many things that we've learned, and we just wanted to share it. And the publisher was very generous with pages, and so we just kept adding more information.
Yeah, I love this. Your bread shots here, too, the loaf of bread.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, and not to mention this mile-high pumpkin pie. How tall is that meringue?
Oh, it's about 5 or 6 inches. That one is actually inspired by when we went to see Thomas Keller. In Napa, we stopped at a favorite restaurant of mine, Mustard's Grill.
Oh, I know Mustard's, yeah.
And they have a pie like that. And that we do very advocates of best practices. So, Bettina and I were inspired by that. That pie in that cookbook.
Now, in your interview with or your profile of Dan Barber, you talk about the seasons from the perspective of a restaurant and a farm-to-table guy. When the climate is sort of against him, like it is in Hamilton, Ontario, and like it is in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. What's the secret to surviving farm to table wise between November and March?
Well, the first secret we think is to don't beat yourself up about this. We're very realistic in our approach, and Dan Barber it was actually quite satisfying to hear that he doesn't, his menu isn't 100% local, especially in these seasons. So first of all, it has to be easy and reasonable, but we do take extra steps through the summer to freeze things. We freeze corn, we freeze peas, lots of berries freeze very well, and when they defrost, they sort of burst, and they make great vinaigrettes, like a blueberry vinaigrette.
Now, guess who does that? We're picking raspberries and blackberries from our garden right now, and
perfect.
And stashing
and so
them.
Ziploc bag. We spread them out onto a tray, a sheet pan, and freeze them quickly in a simple freezer. And then when they're frozen hard, we put them into Ziploc bags.
That's exactly how it's done. Anne's been doing it for years.
And so that's it. That's one thing that we feel very strongly
about. What do you do
about
your herbs?
Doing
then?
Simple things like that, then feel good about it and feel accomplished. You don't have to do much more.
So
in the winter, we eat imported food. We eat, our preserves. We eat more stews than we would, more meat and more bread and more charcuterie. But ultimately, we're good. We're done. Once you've done that, I think you're like the whole farmer's market thing. If you get to the farmer's market, don't worry about the organic versus the non-organic. You're at the market. You've won. The moral battle is won. So, congratulate yourself for that.
Now, Anne had a question which disappeared under your reply to the previous one. What do you do about fresh herbs?
In the winter?
Yes.
Well, you can grow fresh herbs all year round in pots in your house, in your windowsill.
So you do them either inside or really just outside a warm window?
Yeah, just as a windowsill in the winter is still a warm place for herbs to grow, and we have herbs growing around here year-long.
No, I'm looking at something growing out of the snow that looks like thyme.
Yep.
Well, it's not growing.
it's resting.
Let's put it that way.
But you don't preserve. I mean, I'm looking that. I think says it's okay to do dry oregano, but you're not supposed to dry the other herbs. And some herb woman told me that she rolled her fresh herbs and froze them in plastic or wax paper. And then my latest experiment was I was going to wash them so they have a little moisture on it, then roll them tight and put them in ice cube trays. Does that sound right, like it would work?
Well, yeah, there's lots of ways to do it. I think parsley you can actually chop up and with a little water and freeze them in, like parsley actually survives pretty well. And if you have them in the water in the ice cube trays, that sort of freezes them.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you drop that into soups or stews, the water just is, inconsequential, and then you have your fresh herbs in there. But at home, we just have little pots of basil, and that's what we do.
Ours don't work very well.
So you may
dried herbs, I have not dried herbs ever, really. And that's just that's how we do it.
Mm-hmm. Let's do this before we, just to give the listeners a taste of the book. Perhaps you can each take a recipe that you think illustrates the theme of Earth to Table really well and talk about where the ingredients came from and what's in the recipe and what it's like when it's done.
I'll start.
Go ahead.
For me, it's one of my most favorite recipes is the pan-roasted mushrooms. And the concept of this is getting people to cook again. I think ultimately, convenience is king, and these big, corporations, food industries just give us what we want. And we've sort of forgotten how to cook. And so I included this recipe because it's incredibly easy. It sort of allows you to explore different varieties of mushrooms. So you start sort of looking around. So you get an idea of diversity of food. But more importantly, there's this little tip on cooking these mushrooms on a very high heat, cooking them until all their moisture is evaporated and they actually start to caramelize and get crispy. We all know that caramelized food tastes better. And so I think a lot of cooks and even professional chefs don't cook mushrooms properly. And once you do this, and then as the recipe progresses, once they're done, then you add herbs, garlic, shallots, salt and pepper and butter. And then the mushrooms become this really, incredible stew or sauté. And from that very simple tip, you can take those and put them on toast. You can put them into a rice dish or fried rice. And you can put them into a pasta.
Now, how did you discover that by accidentally overcooking mushrooms once?
No, that's, you know, actually, the person who I learned that from was Tom Colicchio out of Kraft. You know,
oh, yeah.
He speaks very highly of, you know, he sells a lot of Hen of the Woods mushrooms out of New York, and that was an inspiration from that. But I think it's a great little tip that home cooks can use. I always find it funny, all these little tips that we give, how impressed people are about these things that we as professional chefs take for granted. So that's why that recipe's in there, and I hope people, you know, use it and really sort of show off to their family about it.
Now, what about an example on the dessert side?
Well, I think one that's kind of important, one of my main storylines throughout the book is the planting of wheat, and so included a recipe in the book, and it's Red Fife whole wheat bread. And the significance of the Red Fife whole wheat is that it's a Canadian heritage variety of grain, and it has great cultural significance here in Canada. And it was grown in the States as well, but it's become extinct and was brought back in Canada through the Slow Food Arc of Taste. And the Red Fife whole wheat bread recipe is you know, very significant for myself and for Jeff, because we invested so much time into the planting of the wheat, and then in the end we were actually able to, after we planted it, harvested it, we built a bread oven, and then ground the seeds and made bread out of it. So it had this cycle of life in that bread.
So you like
the recipe is actually wheat berries, so it talks about how you can cook out wheat berries, which has a ton of flavor and goodness for you. And bread is something that you eat all year round, and we have local, wheat in Canada is a very important part of our economy, and we have local mills around us where we get all our flours from, and, you know, local microbreweries where we get our beers from, and that's it.
Well, that's fascinating. So you actually grow the wheat in your own little garden?
Well, no, on the farm. We worked at.
Okay.
That year at Manor Run. With Chris Kruger, who's the other character in our
So you have a relationship with this farm.
Yeah.
So that's why you say you grow. Well, that's a really fascinating story. And
by the way, I think farmers are becoming celebs. I see them showing up. Yeah. You said that they ought to be, but I see them showing up on menus all over the place, and this is true in Europe as well.
Sometimes they get their due too. It can't all be about the chefs.
Right.
Have you ever run across Farmer Jones from Huron, Ohio, just across the lake?
No.
He's the alt character farmer. Farmer Jones. Lee Jones. Lee Jones is probably on the web about 10 million times.
Okay.
But he's got a rather fascinating story, and if you do a version 2 of this book, he would be a good guy to talk to, I think.
You can go as a chef and stay there. I forget how many varieties of something he grew.
Well, he'd probably get inspiration. I doubt very much if he can get his produce across international boundaries, although he does ship to Singapore and Hong Kong and other places when celebrity chefs go there, but I think they probably take their stuff in their suitcases.
we're doing the James Beard House in Manhattan in October, and
when
we're going to be putting some stuff in our suitcases as well.
What day will that be?
October 16th, World Food Day, coincidentally.
That's great. Well, those of you who are in New York or who go to New York, be sure to make sure that you plan to go and stop by and meet these wonderful people who we are just delighted to have met on the air. Thank you so much for joining us today, and we wish you well, and we hope you'll keep us posted as you publish more or do more interesting things.
Thank you very much. We're so happy you called.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Well, I just want to repeat one more time. This is one gorgeous book. Check it out on our website.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. We're
moving into an area of special interest to me. It may be a little quirky, but you'll hear about it. The topic is, or the title of the book is Taste of Heaven. And let's hear what this is about. Well, a very interesting, if somewhat unusual, book has landed on our desk. It's called Taste of Heaven by Madeline Sherb, and we're going to have Madeline explain to us what this is all about. Madeline, welcome to On the Menu, and as I told you before, I actually am very interested in monasteries and culinary affairs of monasteries, and have been for quite some time. I did have an idea, though, until reading your book, that nuns made cookies and monks made booze.
Well, that's the some truth to that.
Hello, are you there, Madeline?
Yes, yes.
So tell us what this book is about.
Well, thank you for having me on. And the book is both a travel guide to the monasteries and a guide to the food products that they make. It also includes recipes for people who like to cook. So, for example, you can buy an ingredient that is made by a monk or a nun, and then you can cook at home with that. And it is fun that they make things like candy. They make a lot of chocolate. The book is actually divided into categories. So there's cheese, beer and wine and liqueurs and candy, and then kind of a miscellaneous food category.
Now, you only had a limited number of countries. Was that just because of a limited amount of time, or did you think the countries that you dealt with were particularly special?
Well, it's a very good question, and it was mostly a limited amount of funds. So maybe I would have kept going probably if I were not mostly self-funded. So the way that I ended up choosing monasteries was very interesting. It was mostly just one monastery passing me along to the next. I would arrive at a monastery, I would say to one of the monks, please help me decide where to go next. They all know each other, and they would pick up the phone and call another place and make a reservation for me.
Oh,
so
wow.
It was really lovely.
Yeah, but how did you get to the first one? Every journey has to begin with a first step.
The first one was Our Lady of the Mississippi outside of Dubuque, Iowa, and I chose it for a very specific reason, and that's because I happen to love caramels. So I went to Our Lady of the Mississippi first because my research had told me that they make caramels.
Now, we've been to some of these Benedictine, particularly, monasteries in Europe that date back to the Middle Ages.
Yes.
And they were such elaborate communities. They had guest facilities, they were totally self-sustaining. I guess that they had a lot of money, they were very successful, which is probably why Henry VIII in England had them all raised when he was breaking away from the Vatican, right?
Well,
yes.
it was part of his excuse, and besides, he needed the money.
That's exactly right. Most of the time, there were, you know, a couple of motives for shutting down monasteries. One was political, and one was to confiscate their property.
The interesting thing is, Anne says the Benedictines in Europe historically were they found very, very good locations. They certainly found great farming spots. But they also did the same, curiously, in the United States as well. There's a beautiful Benedictine monastery about 40 miles east of Pittsburgh in La Trobe called St.
Vincent's,
which is most famous at this moment in time because it's the home of the training camp for the Pittsburgh Steelers.
Oh, how fun.
but it is a glorious farming community, and
yes.
Are
they still farming?
I don't think so. I think it became a college.
They still have a mill there. They still grind because that's one of their souvenirs.
I guess they do a little bit, but the biggest business they have right now, apart from renting facilities to the Steelers, is a university there called St. Vincent University.
But they actually have flour and
They still have a mill.
The bread that they make, yeah.
And
how lovely.
The Cistercians were also pretty smart. The Cistercians got some pretty good places, too.
Oh, they had fabulous things. So what were some of the products?
It's so interesting. The Cistercians actually are very pronounced in the book because so many of them now have turned to making food products. So the Cistercians make cheese at Gethsemane Abbey in Kentucky, and they make quite a few different flavors of cheese. They used to have their own herd of cows. Now they just buy their milk, but they still make the cheese. They also make fruitcake, bourbon fudge, which really, oh, it is to die for.
Really?
It's really like drinking, you know, bourbon. And let's see, the Cistercians also, the caramels, those are made by Cistercian nuns. And Cistercian nuns in Massachusetts make some of the best candy you'll ever have. And the Cistercians also in Massachusetts at St. Joseph's Abbey make wonderful, wonderful jams and jellies and preserves. So actually, it was very interesting. I thought I would find more Benedictines making food, but it turned out to be more Cistercians.
Wonderful.
Well, but maybe that's because the people who sent you along knew what it was you were interested in.
Yes, and maybe because they were Cistercians.
So they were self-selecting either because they were Cistercians or because they knew you were interested in food. Now let's not leave out the tremendous tradition for making beer and other potent beverages.
Well, what about Benedictine and brandies? What is that?
Madeline quickly points out in the book that the Benedictines might have contributed the recipe, but they don't make Benedictine the liqueur anymore.
That's exactly right. It was based on a very old, really, I think if I'm not mistaken, a 16th century recipe that was in fact invented at a monastery by a Benedictine monk. But over the centuries, that went into secular hands.
I liked your chartreuse story, where you said that the monks invented it, and then somebody took the recipe away from them.
Yes.
But they couldn't figure out what to do with it. They couldn't figure out how to make it, so they gave it back.
That's right. It was too complicated for regular folks.
Well, I think it's one of the interesting things I think that lies behind this whole monastic life is that certainly you have to get up early every morning and you have to do prayers last thing at night and all that kind of stuff. But other than that, you're really not in a hurry.
Absolutely. That's a good point. And in fact, I think that's what makes the life so beautiful in my mind. Not only that, you know, if you are Catholic, as I happen to be, you do get to pray, you know, at regular intervals of the day, which I actually found very useful. It kind of breaks up your day and reminds you your sort of purpose for all the other work you're doing. But it isn't intrusive, and you have a sense of peace when you're at the monastery that I really have not found anywhere else.
So you actually went and stayed at these places.
Yes, I went on retreat to every monastery that has a full entry in the book. There were some additional monasteries that I didn't have time to get to, which are thrown into the itineraries, the suggested itineraries. But I did a full retreat at every monastery that has a full entry.
And how many years did you spend on this?
Well, actually, it was only 2 years of actual travel and writing. Travel to the monasteries and writing. The book took me 6 years.
But
that's mostly because I was working full time and trying to learn how to write a book proposal and find an agent and find a publisher.
Okay, a good part of it was spent in before you even started to write.
Exactly right.
Now, what did you find about growth or shrinkage, shall we say, which is probably the opposite one considers probably most likely. We read about the Catholic Church having a great deal of difficulty recruiting enough people to be priests. Are the holy houses equally having difficulty attracting a new generation of novitiates, or whatever they're called, who would become brothers and sisters?
This is just such an important question, and I'm not sure whether to say yes or no, because it's kind of a complicated situation. A lot of monks and nuns are getting very, very old. So some of the abbeys I went to, Gethsemane, for example, which had 200 monks after World War II, a lot of ex-armies and other, you know, a lot of ex-soldiers signed up to be monks. And so they had a very large group of monks, 200. It was really one of the largest anywhere. Now they are down to a much, much smaller number, and of that number, the vast majority are, I would say, over 70.
Only right. Moses.
Okay. Yeah.
So without new vocations, these monasteries will not be able to continue to do, you know, the wonderful work that they do. Now, the good news is that even as Catholics are having far, far, far smaller families, for example, I met a monk who was the youngest of 11 children, and he was one of these monks who signed up right after World War II at Gethsemane. Now Catholics have 2 children, 3 children at most. You know, they're having much smaller families. But the good news is that this calling to serve God in this very unusual way, this very contemplative, silent way, still calls people. It's still there. And when I went to the monasteries, yes, I saw fewer vocations, but I saw that they are still coming. And so in this modern day and age, this almost completely secular culture that we now live in, which is very different from one generation ago, where you really could be immersed in a Catholic culture and Catholic schools and church and all of that, now we live in a largely secular culture, and this calling is still being answered. And I think what I would love to share with people is something that I read from a nun in my parish newsletter, and she said, we don't have to pray for more vocations. We have to pray that those who have a vocation will answer yes to God. And I think that's the most beautiful way to really answer that question.
But in the meantime, this is a fascinating piece of philosophy and an interesting piece of living history. But the other good news is the recipes are all pretty good too, right?
Like I say in the book, you can also listen with the ear of your stomach as well as the ear of your heart, as St. Benedict.
Oh, Madeline, you're really extraordinary. I'm so glad we found each other.
Thank you.
And I would highly recommend this book. It's on our website, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
It's on the website.
I put it on our bookshelf just this morning.
It's called A Taste of Heaven, A Guide to Food and Drink Made by Monks and Nuns. And it's just useful in so many different ways. I thank you for writing it.
And
thank you so much for inviting me.
And when you start on the second version, be sure to include Italy.
You have a deal.
They know a lot about food and drink, and the monastic side of it's probably even stronger than the rest.
Yeah, that's where we had that wonderful meal. Where was that in?
Oh yes, yeah, we went to a restaurant which is run by a Franciscan who developed a program that was an alternative to incarceration or other punishment called Mondo X.
Yes.
Well, we went there, and they are you can actually take a room there, but it's a beautiful setting, as all of the in that area is, and they have wonderful talent in the kitchen.
Yeah, they absolutely
and a great wine cellar.
And of course the main reason we chose it is we were in Italy on Easter Sunday, so it seemed like it was an appropriate way to spend Easter Sunday.
And it was.
And there's a long story that goes along with that, because we met a very well-known Italian family that happens to make grappa, which had the same idea we had, and so they were in the same place. So we strongly would recommend that you continue this adventure, and we'll look forward to reporting to our listeners and talking to you again when you do that.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Okay, Madeline, thanks.
All right, have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Well, you just said the words, and I'll say it again, so that's it for another week.
No, I didn't say it. I wasn't connected when I said it.
Oh, I see.
I was just cueing you as to what you were supposed to say. But then we'll see you again. Same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.